Today, a Thanksgiving special about music and migration. Three musicians grapple with the same question, what is home? I'm Marco Werman, along with singer Maclete Hedero, who is taking us on this journey.
We'll ask, what is home for a Sudanese-American artist who spent his childhood moving from one city to another?
You know, you're never going to find your home. It's going to find you.
Or an undocumented Mexican singer who couldn't see her hometown for 16 years.
It was just way too long without smelling those things, without hearing those sounds.
What is home for a DJ from Syria who watches from afar as his country unravels?
Like, for me, music, it's a survival thing.
Movement with Maclete Hedero, that's coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, and a very happy Thanksgiving to you. As is the habit, this is a time when many of us travel home to see family. This year, many of us are wishing we could do that. So if you're hearing my voice, there's a good chance you've made a home right where you are, wherever you may be. It might not be as social or as loud as usual, but it's still home. We're asking a simple question in this special edition of the show today. What is home, and what does it sound like? Our guide for the hour will be Maclete Hedero. She's no stranger to the program. Maclete is a singer, composer, and cultural activist, originally from Ethiopia, now based in San Francisco. Maclete, what a pleasure to have you taking us on this journey today.
Thank you so much, Marco. I'm so glad to be here with y'all.
So let me ask you this. Before we get to the artist you're introducing us to today, can you share a little piece of your own journey? And what role did music play in connecting you to where you're from, Ethiopia, and where you live now in the U.S.?
Yeah, I left Ethiopia when I was a little bit under 2 years old. And I grew up with this sense of a lot had been left behind or a lot remained unsaid. But the ways that we would live our Ethiopian-ness was this very household way. So it was about food and language and music. We grew up hearing artists like Mahmoud Ahmed and Astor Weka. You know, warped, garbled tapes that were precious and that my parents loved. In the Ethiopian music, it was like our little breadcrumbs that we would follow to feel our way back home.
Were those tapes so precious that your parents wouldn't let you play them?
I always found a way. So, you know, fast forward when I start my own musical career, I started thinking, how could I bring my own band to Ethiopia to play a show? And I actually had this really specific dream, like a vision for exactly how I wanted it to happen.
All right, this is sounding pretty good.
So what you need to know is that in the north of Ethiopia, there's a town called Gondar, and it's famous for its castles. They're hundreds of years old, and I became obsessed with this idea of going to Gondar to play a show. But not just me. I wanted to bring together a whole group of other musicians like me, Ethiopians who had grown up in places like Brooklyn and Seattle and Toronto. And I want to take you to that day in 2011 when the show was finally about to happen.
Please take us there.
Yes. I was just going to say the guitar can be a little bit louder. I don't
know if they're open. So we're in Gondar. It's been hot and sunny for days. And then out of nowhere, a huge rainstorm hits. And the electricity starts going on and on. We're not sure what to do, but at around 6 p.m., we just rush to the stage. The crew is there setting up. I see this guy shimmying up a pole, and someone tells me, oh, that guy? He's stealing the electricity from the Red Cross.
You don't need anything but what you already got to make this music, all right? That's all I want to leave in Ghana today, okay?
Yeah. So the show starts. And when my cousin Gabriel Teodros is on stage, power goes out for real. Now I am freaking out. Gabe and I had traveled 9,000 miles together to do this show. There are hundreds of people spread out at the foot of the castles waiting to hear us play. And then they did something strange. Instead of leaving, they came
closer to the stage. They turned on their cars and they drove towards us. I realized, oh my God, they are lighting the stage with their headlights as if to say, keep going, you are here, keep going. And Gabe, he jumps off the stage into the crowd and he's down there rapping a cappella, got everyone moving their hands up and down in that hip-hop boom bap, and then all of a sudden, the power's back. You know, all my life, I had wondered, would there be a place for me in the country where I was born? Me, who sings in English and Amharic with a big accent. Honestly, I didn't know what they would make of me. But that night, at the foot of the castle, something clicked. Keep going, you are here, keep going. You are made of the motion between two countries, and the people, well, they can dance to that. You know, this story, my story, it's not unique. What is home? Where is home? These are very human questions. I always felt like we use music to talk about the things that are hard to talk about. And when you can put it into a song, sometimes you don't have to explain it. You can just press play.
So let's do that. Let's press play. And McLeet, introduce us to the first musician on this journey you're going to take us on.
Let's do it.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm just getting myself ready for my trip to Sudan, and I'm leaving on Friday, so lots of things to do.
This is Ahmed Galab. He performs as Sing Kane.
There's a laundry list of things I have to do when I get there and things I have to drop off to people, and my parents have been calling me every day.
Ahmed spent his childhood in Sudan until the military there overthrew the government in 1989. That's when his family moved to the States. In case you're wondering, this is Sing Kane's music you're hearing right now, and you'll be hearing it throughout the story. Ahmed has toured the world, he's performed on Conan O'Brien, but now he's getting ready for his most meaningful show yet. He's going to play at the Karmakol International Festival in Sudan.
This is the inaugural year, and I don't know if there's been a festival like this in Sudan ever.
This conversation was a few years ago in 2017, and at that time, Sudan had been under economic sanctions for 20 years, with no trade or investment coming from the U.S. When he was younger, Ahmed would actually sneak into the country just to visit his family. Now he's returning as an adult to play his first show in Sudan. And all this is happening just 2 months after the sanctions were lifted.
So this is a pretty big deal, not only because it's a homecoming show, but because I'm curious to see what's going to happen.
It really strikes me how much you and I have in common.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's kind of crazy. Like, my family came to the States when I was just 2 years old, to D.C., and then to Iowa, then 6 years in Brooklyn, a year in Jacksonville, 5 years in Gainesville, Florida, New Haven, Seattle, and San Francisco. And so it's just, you know, I don't often run into people who have that thing, too, that thing where you didn't just leave your home country for another country, but you kept on going.
Absolutely. I didn't live anywhere for longer than 4 years. I was always moving. My parents had to start over. I think that that led me to be a musician, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Being on tour reminds me of my experience growing up, you know,
totally.
Moving all the time, being very transient, meeting new people, going back to places and running into the people that you've met. It feels normal to me.
I'm always fascinated about this moment that Black immigrants African immigrants kind of discover race.
Yeah.
And so was there a moment for you where that happened in your life?
Yeah, definitely when I moved to Ohio. I moved from Provo, Utah to Kent, Ohio. So Provo, Utah being very white, it's very Mormon. And I moved there at such a young age, I kind of assimilated into the culture in a way where I didn't really understand that I was different.
Mm-hmm.
And then the moment I moved to Kent, Ohio, I saw other black people. And that's such a weird experience to talk about, because anyone else growing up, they might be like, how could you not know that you were different? You know, you were the only black kid in your school. But I just didn't see it. I just never saw another black mm-hmm. person. And I mean, it was a crazy culture shock for me. This 13-year-old kid, I went to school, I skateboarded, I wore like a Quicksilver t-shirt, and I was instantly ostracized by everyone. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal for me to be ostracized by white people, because I had just been surrounded by white people all my life. But I had first seen black people, and the first thing they said to me was, you're weird. You act like white people. You talk like white people. You listen to white people's music. What kind of person are you? Oh, you're African. That means you're not black. Like, all of this crazy racial conversation being presented to me for the first time in my life. And, you know, my dad had done an all right job of like preparing me for all that kind of stuff.
What did he say?
He would just tell me that you need to understand that you have three strikes against you. You're black. You are a Muslim, and you can still be considered a foreigner. And he would drill that into my head time and time and time and time and time again. And the first time I really experienced that was when I was 13. I had no place to go other than, you know, running into a few friends who would accept me for who I am, you know. And I was introduced to the punk rock community, where everyone was scrutinized in a similar way. And they were like, you know what, it's okay for you to be who you are, and we accept that.
That's a hard age, too.
Yeah. It really allowed me to understand that people who are exactly like you aren't the only people who can understand your experience or your struggle. You know, the struggle is universal. The travel ban came right as one of my cousins had, you know, had just moved to the U.S. And after he had moved to the U.S., his father passed away. And he wasn't able to go back to Sudan to be with his mom, you know. And it was the first time that I felt like directly hit. And it gave me a lot of fuel, you know. I wanted to say, this isn't new. This feeling that we have collectively isn't new. It's always been this way, you know. And through every generation, there was something that we had to deal with. And everything's going to be all right. And after the travel ban happened, I realized, you know, I have a duty, I have a soapbox, and it made me want to tour more, and it made me want to play harder, you know, and it led us to the show in Sudan that we're going to in a week. And, you know, it's really taught me that you set your sights on something and you can get it. Your energy will take you there.
Coming up, Sinkane meets his idol, catches a glimpse of the spot where his ancestors came from, and finally takes the stage in Sudan.
You're listening to a special hour of the world, Movement with Maclete Hedero. Don't go away. Maclete will be right back here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you're just joining us, we're doing something special on the show today. Stories about music and migration, with singer Maclete Hedero as our guide.
Thank you, Marco. Okay, so we're going to pick up the story of Ahmed Galab, better known as Sing Kane, who has just traveled from the U.S. to Sudan to play his very first show there.
So it's been about an hour and a half since we left Khartoum, and we're still in Khartoum.
Ahmed is on a bus from Khartoum, Sudan's capital, to Karmakol, way up in the north of the country. That's where the festival is happening. And someone very special is on the bus with Sing Kane.
Sher Habir is here. My biggest musical influence from Sudan is here.
So can you tell us a little bit about who he is and why it was a big deal to you to meet him?
Sher Habir is the godfather of Sudanese jazz music. And he has this really unique voice that almost seems like he's like singing you to sleep. Anything that I make that sounds Sudanese references his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I showed him a video of me performing one of his songs. I was like almost shaking, you know, I was like, because he doesn't say much. He kind of like took the phone and brought it really close to his ear so we could hear it. It was almost felt like I was waiting for his approval, like I was waiting for my father's approval or something. We are just arriving at Karmakol.
So was the festival, like, pretty much the only thing that was happening in town in Karmakol?
It was the only thing that I think has ever happened in that town. It's this really, really tiny town. These mud houses, camels, and old Sufi tombs in the graves, which look like giant beehives, you know, everywhere. And then this, like, brand new, gigantic, modern-looking stage in the middle of all of that.
Are we good?
Yep. One guy came up to me after our sound check and said, you know, I only have a fifth grade education, and I told my kids that if they really want to amount to something, to look up at the stage, and they could really, if they really wanted to, they could be like you, you know?
Oh.
I've never heard any parent say that to me in my entire life.
How do you prepare to get on the stage? And what was that actual moment when you walked on stage? What was that like for you?
I walked all the way over by the Nile, warming up my voice, and it's totally pitch black, dark. About to play my first concert in Sudan, and my idol, Sher Habir, is performing right in front of me. And I stopped and ran up onto the stage to hear it.
This is Gulbi Daga right now. He's playing my parents' wedding song, so it's crazy. Sentimental.
And I get to my band, and I looked up and I saw like everyone very patiently waiting for the show. You know, all the men on one side, all the women on the other side, and all like the kids from Khartoum in the back. It was very controlled. That's kind of what it's like in Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
When Sher Habir was playing, and throughout like the day, it just seemed like everyone was very reserved. And we started playing our song, Aha, was the third song of our set. The whole place just lit up. Everyone started getting up. The men weren't only on one side. The women weren't only on one side. And the people from Khartoum weren't in the back. The whole crowd just mixed into the middle. There was one part of the set where a kid from the town, like a local kid, just jumped up on stage and he said, you know, I got to get going. Is it cool if I get your phone number? And I was like, what? Like, oh, yeah, this has never happened in this town before. There's no protocol for a show. They don't know what to do. They just kind of figure maybe I'll just go up on stage and talk to this person. I can do that, you know?
It kind of reminds me of what we were talking about in one of our earlier conversations about universalism.
Mm-hmm.
Like these folks who were more reserved or didn't necessarily connect before, all of a sudden they had like a platform around which they could all kind of like enjoy themselves and let loose.
Yeah, it kind of felt like Footloose. Like this was like a full-fledged rock and roll show, and it really like busted a seal And I bet this hasn't happened in Sudan before.
I like started messing up at the beginning of the set because I was crying. It was crazy. I can't even say anything. My throat, I've lost my voice. I never lose my voice. This is amazing. I can't believe this happened.
There was this one other story from Ahmed's trip that stuck with me. Just made me think back to our first conversation when he told me about always wondering where he belonged. One day when Ahmed was back in Sudan, his aunt took him for a drive, but she didn't tell him where they were going.
We're just driving on this street and then take a turn into this dirt road and go up a hill. And it's just like this flatland desert. And far off in the distance, there's a patch of trees. It almost looks like an oasis. It's really far away. And she sat me down and she said, your grandfather, when he was growing up, he lived here. And there's nothing there. There's nothing there at all anymore, you know?
Wow.
And about 11 years ago, the last time I was there, I had this amazing experience with one of the town elders.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, you come from a nomadic people. And if you were to go to the place where your grandfather grew up, where we came from, it would just be a bunch of bush. And I'm telling you this because you're not ever going to find where you're from. You know, you're never going to find your home. It's going to find you. And until then, you got to continue searching. And then 11 years later, my aunt takes me to this place where my grandfather grew up, you know, and he was right. You know, it was just a bunch of bush. And to see like the distance that they came from and where my family lives now, you know, where I grew up and how much traveling I've been doing to find a place to call home. It was just a very amazing experience. Ultimately, it reminds me of my duality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my identity as a Sudanese person and my identity as an American person. And for the first time in my life, I went back to Sudan and I was at peace with my duality.
This is Movement. I'm Makli Tadero. Stay with us as we follow a Mexican singer making sense of her own duality, divided by a border that she doesn't dare to cross.
We'll be right back. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman.
I'm Makli Tadero, and this is The World.
Today, we're telling the stories of immigrant musicians in search of a place to call home.
I didn't have anything. I didn't have a laptop. I didn't have my files.
I think I still feel a little bit like an outsider.
Those stories just ahead on this Thanksgiving musical edition of The World.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. We're doing something special this Thanksgiving, Stories of Homecoming. Singer and composer Makli Tadero is our host. Makli, what have you got for us next?
So for our second story, I actually want to introduce you to a dear, dear friend of mine. She's originally from Mexico, and her name is Diana Gameros.
Tick, 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 one, two, tick, tick, tick.
So I've known Diana for about 12 years.
Do you have like a favorite sound check song? You know how people...
We met in the Mission District of San Francisco when we were both young artists just starting our careers.
I'll just make it up as I...
Let's do one right now.
All seven and we watch them fall. Because I'm singing that song.
We would often perform at the same neighborhood festivals in like garages and backyards and living rooms and studios. Always free. Always packed and full of life.
And I have to bring a stand, a music stand, even though
we got to know each other at after parties and sound checks. You know,
two songwriters with guitars and the sounds of our homelands. I knew she was something special right from the start. So one of the amazing things about Diana is that her whole story is there in her music. There's one song in particular I'm thinking of called En Juarez. And what I want to do is kind of tell you her story through that song.
Great. We're all ears.
Can you tell me the story of the song En Juarez and what the process of composing it was like?
Sure. I remember I had just moved to San Francisco. I didn't have family there. And so I remember that I would reflect more about all that time that Juarez was in the news.
Maria Caridad's husband and two sons were kidnapped and executed.
Over 30 girls have gone missing in similar circumstances since 2009.
Because 2008, 2009 were some of the roughest years for Juarez.
This year alone, more than 500 people, or nearly 7 people a day, have been killed in Juarez.
Regarding the feminicides and the drug cartels.
That is increasingly run by drug cartels.
And one of the most dangerous in the world.
Very vividly, I remember that I started thinking about the park that I used to play in Juarez. Then I started remembering about the time when I was little and how you would see a lot of kids out on the streets. It was a song that a mother would sing, you know, come here, my little children. I'm going to tell you about the time when we could still dream. And so, in a way, En Juarez was a way for me to comfort myself, comfort the children in a city as violent and as dangerous as Ciudad Juarez.
Verán que la vida va bien.
Now, there's a reason Diana wrote that song in San Francisco and not in Juarez. And the reason begins with music.
I think I kind of always knew that I was going to do music.
Diana comes from a very musical family. Her grandmother taught her folk songs as a little girl. And her mother was a singer also.
She would walk me to a church that was giving guitar lessons for free.
She nurtured Diana's dreams of studying music.
Probably the guitar was bigger than I was, and so she was carrying it with no case.
Ultimately, it was that dream of studying music that led Diana to leave her home and come to the United States.
And so I tried my best to become an international student, you know, in the, you know, the legal way.
At first, she came on a tourist visa to stay with some family in Michigan for just a couple months.
I kind of went back and forth. I mean, I always had a visa and was able to travel freely.
But then when Diana applied for a student visa, she ran into trouble because her parents didn't earn enough money to prove that they could cover all her expenses.
You know, I kept failing and failing. And so I decided to stay and went through 4 years of college completely as an undocumented student.
After college, those 4 years turned into 5, then 10.
Yeah, and then fast forward 15 years, I'm still here.
Just imagine that. Diana's hometown, Ciudad Juarez, is on the U.S.-Mexico border. She can walk right up to the bridge that connects El Paso, Texas to Juarez, Mexico. She can walk right up to the fence that divides the two countries, but she knows that if she crosses that fence, she might never be able to cross back.
And so she stayed and built her career here, starting at a little tamale parlor in San Francisco.
It used to be painted orange, and there was a sombrero on top of where I would play.
She found the gig as soon as she arrived in the city in 2008.
And I go on Craigslist, and then there's this ad in Spanish that read, "Solicitamos cantante."
Basically, the restaurant wanted a singer, someone who could do ballads and Mexican pop songs.
You know, music in English and in Spanish. It almost, for me, it was like it had my name, like Diana Gameros, we need you. Because it's everything that I could do. And then I come to the, what I think it's an interview, and the guy said, okay, so can you start today?
Since that first gig, Diana has performed all around the U.S., sharing stages with folks like Joan Baez and the San Francisco Symphony. Wherever she went, Diana sang the song En Juarez and told audiences about her hometown as she remembered it. Yet she didn't dare to play it in the one place she wanted to most, in Ciudad Juarez. But when Diana and I sat together in the tamale parlor, she could picture her homecoming show in her mind.
I know that it's going to be outdoors. I can already feel the breeze. I'm probably going to, like, I'm already ready for maybe one or two songs not being able to sing them because I'm going to be crying, you know? But, and it's really this feeling of, like, the air. For some reason, the thing that keeps coming to me is the sort of the air, the... And I kind of feel the breeze. Soy sin permiso, soy sin papel.
I am with or without a paper, with or without a document. I am because everything comes from the earth, and just for the simple fact of being, it just is.
Porque todo de la tierra ha venido. Y sigue estando vivo, vivo.
A few months after that conversation, Diana finally received her green card. I can remember the party she threw to celebrate. There were about 30 of us there, spread out on blankets with tons of food and instruments. It almost felt like a wedding where the guest of honor drifts around to different groups of people to celebrate with each one of them. And then, after 16 years away, she finally went home in the fall of 2018. And now she's been back several times since.
So what we want to do right now is talk through the trip to Juarez when you were there to perform. Mm. So maybe we can just start at the beginning when you arrived in Juarez.
My mom's home is very colorful. And there's kids. You know, I have my nephews that live next door, my brother. We are all into music, and so it's a very festive vibe, and everybody speaks very loudly. I've always found it so important that families stick together, you know, and it might be contradictory to the path I chose, which was leave my family, but maybe that's why I appreciate it now more, because I didn't have it. There was another beautiful thing that happened. I got to collaborate with young musicians that are part of the university, the Universidad Autónoma de Ciudad Juárez.
Juan Leal, I play drums.
Bass player.
Karina Torres, and I play the double bass.
A clarinetist.
Diana Jimenez, and I play the clarinet.
They would be the band for Diana's first show in Juárez.
To me, that was very meaningful because when I left Juárez, that music department didn't exist. You could not get a bachelor's in music. But at the same time, it was challenging because, you know, I went to music school in the U.S., and so my musical vocabulary is in English mainly. I remember finding it difficult to communicate with them because I would throw all these words in English. You know, I was also very nervous because we didn't have time to rehearse, you know, because I had just arrived to Mexico. And so just one rehearsal, that's what was going to happen, you know.
Leaving the rehearsal hall that day, Diana couldn't help but marvel at how much had changed in the years that she was away.
I think I was about their age when I left, you know, when I left in search for a music program, and, you know, I immigrated to the United States, and when I left, none of this existed. That big theater, we didn't have, you know, places where...
The murder rate in Juarez peaked exactly a decade ago, in 2010, and then began to fall. Businesses have reopened, nightlife has returned, and so this is the Juarez that Diana is returning to. It's not the Juarez of her childhood, but it's also not the Juarez that she heard about on the news for all those years.
You know, it's sort of like I'm seeing the place after the storm has passed. Before each performance, I usually take a few minutes to reflect and to thank life for the opportunity. And it took me a few minutes to sort of have it sink in. You know, when I first arrived in Mexico, I was receiving. Everything was receiving. But then when I got to perform, I was finally giving them a piece of me, telling them through music, I am here. This is me. You know, seeing people's faces. And for me, they were just the most beautiful faces I've ever seen, the most beautiful audience. You know, I long so much to sing for them that was the moment it was happening. Of course I sang in Juarez, and to me, you know, singing that song for my people is like saying to them, you know, I'm sorry I wasn't here for all this, but here I am now, and I thought of you this whole time. You have been on my mind, and I want to make up for it, and hopefully this song will serve as an offering.
Wow. I mean, MacLeod, the emotion of home and how powerful the sensation was for Diana to return to Juarez. I mean, joy, sadness, guilt. What a catharsis to finally go back home.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is a catharsis, that return. I remember growing up when we couldn't go back to Ethiopia because we had left clandestinely. It was such a weight to live with that. For our last story today, an artist who's left and has still not been back. And even if he did go back, there's no saying what he would actually find there.
That's MacLeod Hadero, our guide this hour, on this special Thanksgiving Day edition of The World. What a fascinating hour so far. Movement, this Thanksgiving special, is stories of immigrant musicians, each of them grappling with a common question: what is home? For this final story, our guide MacLeod Hadero speaks with a Syrian artist who, again and again, has been forced to pick up and make a new home.
At this point, how many countries have you lived in over the past decade?
So, Syria, Lebanon, Minnesota, and now I'm in Turkey.
It's interesting that you said Minnesota and not necessarily the United States.
Oh, yeah. Minnesota's home.
So, on that journey between those four countries, you were making music the whole time, right?
Yes. That's the only thing. I never stopped.
Like, for me, music, I don't take it as like a normal thing. It's a survival thing.
My name is Samer Samed Dahar. I was born in Aleppo, Syria. I'm the guy behind the music project Hello Psych Aleppo.
So, can you tell us about your hometown, where you grew up, and memories of place that really stand out to you?
Mm-hmm. Sweet. Aleppo is a wonderful city. It's ancient. And at night, it was just so beautiful. Sitting next to the citadel, playing cards with your friends, and listening to Umm Kulthum at night. Arabic music was mostly everywhere, tarab music, especially in Aleppo.
So tell me about electro tarab.
That started when I was back home in Aleppo and just experimenting. I combined samples, names like Abd al-Halim from Egypt, Fahad Balan from Syria, classic old stuff, and brought them to like drum and bass and dubstep and, you know, electronic music genres. People started to ask me, like, what is this you're playing? And, you know, the shortest answer for that was electro and tarab. So that's the combination. I feel like this is a movement that's happening everywhere because it's very natural.
Right.
It's culture and tools.
So could you take us through the journey that you've been on, starting, I guess maybe it was a decade ago?
Yeah, 2012.
Lead us through it.
Totally. So I was studying fine arts in Aleppo and I graduated in 2012. And things started in Syria in 2011.
The scenes are unprecedented. Day after day of protest. Syrians now demanding what Tunisians and Egyptians have just won.
And things took off from there.
The answer came quickly and violently.
That moment, I was back in my studio in Aleppo and I was writing a piece for my first album called PH. It was so peaceful and like gunfires were like, you know, blasting outside. I was like just in a different place. I was like, what's happening outside doesn't really, I don't relate to it, you know.
After that, I decided to go to Lebanon. I left Syria with a plan of going back after a month. I stayed there for like 3 years, actually. Starting 2015, they released a new law that doesn't allow foreigners, if they don't have a work permit, to stay in Lebanon. So because I was a freelancer, I had to leave to the U.S.
So at the time that you left Lebanon, Aleppo had just been devastated by fighting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you were feeling in this period?
As a musician, I felt very, very helpless. But then after that, like, I came to a conclusion that if I make like a youngster busy for 5 minutes to quit all that mess outside, I feel like that's like an act against war. That's the most I can do. We went to the States for 5 years. And after that, moved to Turkey to reunite with my parents. Because, you know, after the travel ban, I couldn't have my parents come to the U.S. even for a visit. That's one of the reasons I'm in Turkey right now.
Do you see yourself returning to Aleppo at some point?
That's a big question when you know, like, I know people went back after a while and they asked themselves, like, is this like Aleppo that we knew before? It's like everything has changed. The places that you knew aren't there anymore. In 2017, I released an album called Tiyur. It's a conceptual album. Tiyur means birds in Arabic. So I collected old Arabic songs that talks about birds. The artist Esmahan, her song is called Ya Tiyur, Ghanni Hubbi. O birds, sing my love and chant my hopes.
Why birds?
Just the idea of it is freeing. You know, freedom of movement. Freedom of being with the, you know, with the ones you love. And you're always in a survival mode when you don't have that, you know?
When you don't have freedom of movement, when you can't be with the ones you love, you are in survival mode. Here's to doing better than surviving. Macleet, are you with people you love today, this Thanksgiving?
I am. I am surrounded with love this Thanksgiving, and I am so grateful.
And we're hoping that that's the case for all of you listening to the program today. Movement, this one-hour special, was produced by Macleet Todaro, Ian Koss, and Julie Kane, with support from Cal Humanities. Special thanks also to Martina Castro at Adonde Media. To hear more music from the artists featured today, head over to theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll be back with you here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at FJC.org, Bob Arthur and Susan Anderson, and the Bilo Chacon Family Foundation. And by the GBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
PRX. From PRX.